Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us at the Heritage Foundation. I'm John Hilbolt, Director of Lectures and Seminars. It's my privilege to welcome you to our Lehrman Auditorium. Abraham Foxman is the National Director of the Anti-Defamation League. He is known throughout the world as a leader in the fight against anti-Semitism, hatred, prejudice, bigotry, and discrimination. He has worked for the ADL since 1965 and was named director in 1987. It is my pleasure to welcome to Heritage Abraham Foxman.
Thank you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of time and brevity, I prepared my remarks so that we have a little bit more time to interact on Q&A. How did I come to write The Deadliest Lies? When I had promised myself after publishing my book Never Again that that was it. I'm not ready to travel the country to promote another book. Well, basically, because I saw a new surprising threat to American Jews and to civil society arising in our midst. As the National Director of the Anti-Defamation League for over 20 years and working at ADL for 40 years, I've seen anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, the kind that have been the source of pogroms and the Holocaust in Europe, flourishing in America only among the usual suspects.
There's never been a pogrom, which is a Jewish name for attacks against Jews. There's never been a pogrom in the United States in 400 years, yet we have multi-million dollar organizations like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which claim that there's enormous activity, anti-Semitic throughout the United States, and that Jews are in immediate peril of annihilation here. And this is pure mythology. There's no basis for it whatsoever. But on the basis of this mythology, they raise hundreds of millions of dollars of tax-exempt money in the United States, and the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation both completely back this program of illegal money raising for a fake organization. And they all should be in prison for it.
The usual suspects. By that I mean such haters as the Ku Klux Klan, Aryan Nations, the Nation of Islam, David Duke, once in a while Pat Buchanan. Nothing surprising about reading in those organizations, publications or websites, charges about Jewish control. Jewish control here, there, and especially Jewish control of America.
The Shah of Iran was unusually and refreshingly open. None of the Shah's comments raised hackles like his blast at the American Jewish lobby. Its influence, he claimed, went all the way to the top.
Surely, Your Majesty, you're not telling me that the Jewish lobby in the United States pulls the strings of the presidency?
Not entirely, but I think even a little too much, even for Israel interests.
You think the Jewish lobby in the United States is too powerful for the interests of Israel?
I think so. Sometimes they are disturbing the interests of Israel.
Explain.
Because they're pushing around too many people.
Why would the President of the United States pay attention to that lobby?
They are strong.
Strong in what sense?
They are controlling many things.
Controlling what?
Newspapers. Medias.
Your Majesty.
Banks. Finances. And I'm going to stop there.
Well, now wait just a second. You really do believe that the Jewish community in the United States is that powerful? They make the media reflect their view of foreign policy?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Jewish control of America.
The Israeli puppeteer travels to Washington. The Israeli puppeteer meets with the puppet in the White House and then moves down Pennsylvania Avenue and meets with the puppets in Congress and then takes back billions of taxpayer dollars.
One of the favorite terms these racist organizations use is ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government.
Well, appropriate of that, some years ago, Admiral Thomas Moore, who was chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said this, and it's quoted in the book by former Congressman Paul Finley. He said, "I've never seen a president, I don't care who he is, stand up to them," that is the Israeli. "It just boggles the mind. They always get what they want. The Israelis know what is going on all the time. I got to the point where I wasn't writing anything down. If the American people understood what a grip those people have got on our government, they would rise up in arms. Our citizens certainly don't have any idea what goes on," unquote. Now, that's the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of the top military man in the United States.
Yeah.
If he knows it, and everyone in Washington knows this, but the American people, unfortunately, are not rising up in arms.
And during the first Gulf War, even Pat Buchanan described Congress as Israel-occupied territory. I never minimized the significance of such bigotry. Remember that Oklahoma City bombing was a product of this kind of thinking. Still, when anti-Semitic thinking stays in the margins of society, we're not doing badly. Most Americans know how to deal with diatribes from hate groups. They reject them as un-American. They isolate the leaders and condemn them as divisive and hateful.
It's not because anybody hates Jews. I don't think you hate Jews.
I don't hate Jews at all.
And I don't hate Jews because I have no reason to hate Jews.
However, I began to see something far more serious, a blame the Jews mentality not coming from the margins of our society, but from its mainstream establishment, infecting, if you will, civil society. There is a history of this in this country, which has been so good for Jews, so tolerant, so accepting, but it was, we thought, buried in a distant past. I refer to the period before World War II, a time of anxiety in America, a time when the infamous radio priest, Father Coughlin, was airing anti-Semitic rants to millions of Americans every Sunday night. And into that mix came a Charles Lindbergh, an American hero, and as head of America First Movement, the group fighting against U.S. entry into World War II, Lindbergh accused the, quote, powerful and influential Jews, end quote, of trying to bring America to war against the interests of this country. This was a low point for Jews in America. Still, it was almost seven decades ago, and we've come a long way, or so I thought. One ominous sign came in the year 2003, when a congressman from Virginia, Jim Moran, blamed the war in Iraq on neoconservative Jews.
I was reading one, Roy, from a Jewish writer, William Shannon, and he was just saying that the headline was, "Jewish writer claims powerful Zionists drove U.S. into Middle East for the sake of Israel." And he's talking about, you know, 2003, some of the people he mentioned, James, now just as the, you're, I think you're, but when Congressman James Moran, a Democrat from Virginia, told an audience the leaders of the American Jewish groups were pushing America into war with Iraq, he was denounced as an anti-Semite. And was pressured to resign. You have people like Pat Buchanan saying the same thing. You had people like Jimmy Carter coming out about the corruption of this lobby, and everyone is instantly an anti-Semite.
Well, that's their defense, is just call them a racist.
Well, I mean, this one, if we bring this into politics and, you know, we're getting down to different districts and whatever, it's very easy. These people label someone an anti-Semite. It's very hard to get off the floor.
It is, but it's like, what's it called, the boy who cried wolf. You can only use the same excuse and tactic so many times before the people don't pay attention to it anymore. And they're kind of running that dry.
Yeah, but
especially,
I,
you know, some
I,
little
I,
district
I,
in Virginia
just,
or Texas is like your anti-Semite, so, you know.
Yeah.
No, he didn't say neoconservatives. He said very clearly neoconservative Jews.
Neoconservatives are obviously in positions of influence and are well-placed throughout our government and the media. The neoconservatives, a name they gave themselves, diligently worked their way into positions of power and influence. Many neocons now in position of influence in Washington can trace their status back to Professor Leo Strauss of the University of Chicago. Paul Wolfowitz actually got his PhD under Strauss. Others closely associated with these views are Richard Perle, Elliot Abrams, Robert Kagan, William Kristol. All are key players in designing our new strategy of preemptive war. Others include Michael Ledeen of the American Enterprise Institute, former CIA Director James Woolsey, Bill Bennett, Frank Gaffney, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. The godfather of modern-day neoconservatism is considered to be Irving Kristol, father of Bill Kristol. More important than the names of people affiliated with neoconservatism are the views they adhere to. They believe lying is necessary for the state to survive. They are for redrawing the map of the Middle East and are willing to use force to do it. They unconditionally support Israel and have a close alliance with the Likud party. They believe pertinent facts about how a society should be run should be held by the elite and withheld from those who do not have the courage to deal with it. Can freedom and the republic survive this takeover?
A neoconservative Jews, attributing to them the power to determine American policy based on what they believed was good for Israel and not America. Not for America. More disturbing that the statements itself was more disturbing than his statement was the lack of rigorous rebuttal, suggesting that there might be a latent sympathy to his comments.
Congressman James Moran was denounced as an anti-Semite and was pressured to resign.
More disturbing than his statement was the lack of rigorous rebuttal. Maybe what happened next was influenced by the limited reaction to Congressman Moran's remarks.
Jim Moran might be defeated, an incumbent from Virginia, because he said the war in Iraq was for Israel. And the whole press, ABC network, your alphabet soup, was up on his grill about that, and he had to get up on TV and apologize for it. Years later, look how right he was.
For then we saw Professor John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, associated with two of America's most prestigious academic institutions, the University of Chicago and Harvard, published a paper titled, quote, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. In it, they repeat Moran's accusation, but go far beyond it in constructing a classical conspiracy theory about alleged Jewish power and control in this country. This was not the KKK or Aryan Nations. This was Harvard and Chicago professors with good reputations and with their serious credentials. And I feared that they would be received with a far more greater credibility than their outlandish fantasies warranted. And I worried that their paper would become standard fare in college curricula.
These people are liars. They never tell the truth. And they call some people extremes. The Arabs are extremists and all that. It's just the old canards. And you have criminal organizations, as mentioned by Farrakhan. The ADL. These guys are extremists. Go check out their site. They're bloody extremists. And this Abe Foxman's a piece of trash. The guy's a piece of trash. And you have this other piece of trash, Alan Dershowitz, dirtbag, and saying that they're trying to install in every college, every university in the world, a Jewish office to explain the Jewish propaganda. Because they need to explain this Zionist propaganda to us, because it doesn't go down well, because it's a lie. My next little thing, which is I'm going to go look for the clip. I'm going to play that, and I'll be back in a second.
Professor Alan Dershowitz, a friend of Chabad at Harvard University, shared some thoughts on Chabad's campus network.
Wow, what a gathering. The energy, the love, the Yiddishkeit in this room are beyond belief. Whenever I hear people talk about the diminution of Judaism around the world, I wish they could be here tonight to experience this. And that's why the fight for the minds, the hearts, the souls of college students today is so important. And that's why we must extend a collective Yasher Koach to people like the Zarkis, to others of the Shalichim at Penn, at Connecticut, some who I've met tonight, at Princeton. I'm going to leave out places, I'm going to leave out names. But we cannot rest until there is at least one Chabad Shaliach on every major college campus in the world.
I'm going to stop it there because this guy made me sick here. This dirtbag saying that they need to spread out to all the college campuses and universities in every city in the world. They're not my words, but that's the plan. So that's in his own words. Of what needs to be done, that they need to infiltrate. He didn't use the word infiltrate because they don't use that. The ADL doesn't use that.
Things got worse when soon thereafter former President Jimmy Carter came out with a book called Palestine, Peace or Apartheid. It was bad enough that the former president made the inappropriate analogy of Israel's policies to that of apartheid South Africa. Even worse, was his taking up the cudgels of Mearsheimer and Walt in attributing American support of Israel to Jewish control of policy.
Well, the acknowledgement of that power, as you point out, is now so widespread that former President Jimmy Carter has gotten into trouble.
You mean that anti-Semite?
Called anti-Semite, or David Horowitz calls him a Jew hater of all things.
There you go.
When asked by the Louisville Courier Journal shortly after the publication of his book whether he agreed with Mearsheimer and Walt's thesis, he succinctly said, "Yes, I do." And in further explanation as to why he wrote the book, he said, "Well, you see, American narrative, Middle East, is so controlled by the Israel lobby in the media and universities that he felt it necessary to write this book in order to put forward and advocate another narrative."
Very few people can put up with, in their own life, with their friends, their wives, and so forth, the kind of smears that come as a result of this. And Jimmy Carter saw a whole lot of members of the board of the Jimmy Carter Center that he runs resign in protest as a result of his statement that, completely true statement, that American politicians are enormously intimidated by the power of this lobby.
So when my publisher approached me about doing a follow-up book to Never Again, Son of Never Again, I made it clear that the only book I was interested in doing was a rebuttal and expose of the deadliest lies. It was not good enough, in my opinion, to have occasional op-ed pieces or comments about the threat. A more serious effort was imperative. So I see my book as serving several purposes. First, it is to give historical context to the kind of assaults on the Jewish people that emanate from Mearsheimer and Walt and Carter. The reason anti-Semitism has had such a long and lethal history is because this type of conspiracy theory about Jews are all powerful, Jews are alien, Jews work against the interests of their own country, has been used by demagogues to explain anxiety-provoking issues in society.
Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa had his invitation to a university withdrawn because his acknowledgement of this same situation was regarded as anti-Semitic. It's just unbelievable.
If universities are considering using Mearsheimer and Walt's paper or their expanded version in book form, I hope that they will see the deadliest lies as an important counterweight so that students will be able to fairly evaluate the charges that they made. Towards that end, I spend a good deal of space in my book dissecting Mearsheimer, Walt, and Carter's misuse of sources and fallacious analysis of the causes of certain events. I describe how one does not have to be pro-Zionist to see how transparently biased they are in describing the history of the Arab-Israel conflict. In their view, Israel is wrong on every occasion. The refugee problem from the 1948 war, a war started by five Arab states, they say Israel evicted the Arabs in a planned way. no matter that any serious historian acknowledges that there were many factors behind a flight, as there is in every war. The Camp David meeting of 2000, they say Israel didn't make a serious offer to the Palestinians. No matter that President Clinton and indeed most of the world believed that Yasser Arafat turned down a significant offer from Ehud Barak, which could have resulted in a Palestinian state and a better life for the Palestinians. Israel is an asset to the United States and the region. They say Israel hurts America and is the key to all of America's regional problems.
Israel may have been a strategic asset during the Cold War, but the Cold War is now over. Today, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons why we have a terrorism problem, and it makes it harder to address a range of other problems in the Middle East. Support for Israel is not the only source of anti-Americanism, of course, and our problems in the Middle East would not disappear if the United States had a more normal relationship with Israel. The United States does benefit from some forms of strategic cooperation with Israel, but it is hard to argue that giving it nearly unconditional backing is making the U.S. more popular around the world or making American citizens more secure. On balance, it is now a strategic liability.
It's the cause of terrorism. It's the reason we are hated. No matter that very different presidents like Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George Bush, and secretaries of state like George Shultz.
I doubt very much during that ceremony at the White House, they quoted President Harry Truman's diary of July 21st, 1947. Of course, you know, Harry Truman was the president who was the first American president to formally recognize Israel as a sovereign state. Now, the diaries have never been formally published. Harry Truman, who recognized the state of Israel, wrote in his diary on July 21st, 1947, as follows, and this was cited in the Washington Post on July 11th, 2003. Truman wrote, "The Jews have no sense of proportion, nor do they have any judgment on world affairs. The Jews, I find, are very, very selfish. They care not how many Estonians, Latvians, Finns, Poles, Yugoslavs, or Greeks get murdered or mistreated as post-war displaced persons as long as the Jews get special treatment. Yet when they have power, physical, financial, or political, neither Hitler nor Stalin has anything on them for cruelty or mistreatment to the underdog." Provocative. And that's putting it lightly. Mike Piper didn't say that, ladies and gentlemen. Harry Truman said that. President of the United States.
Made it clear that Israel is a vital strategic asset for America in a region where extremism and instability are rampant. They built a paradigm. Israel is not moral. Israel is not democratic. Israel is not a weak state under continuous siege and attack.
As for the claim that Israel is a democracy that shares our values, yes, Israel is a democracy, but so are many other states, and none get anywhere near as much support, and certainly don't get it unconditionally. Plus, Israel's treatment of its Arab citizens and its Palestinian subjects are sharply at odds with U.S. values. I want to emphasize that there is a strong moral case, in my opinion, for Israel's existence, based on the long history of anti-Semitism. But its existence is fortunately not in jeopardy, and past crimes against the Jewish people do not justify giving Israel a blank check today.
So why? Why does America support it? Well, because it's in America's interest.
Some say the United States backs Israel because there is broad public support. Politicians are just doing what the public wants. This argument isn't persuasive for several reasons. Americans do have a generally favorable image of Israel, in part because media coverage tends to be favorable. But they do not think that the United States should give unconditional or one-sided aid to the Jewish state. A survey conducted for the Anti-Defamation League in 2005 found that 78% of Americans think that the United States should favor neither side in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's 78% of Americans in an ADL study. Another survey conducted by the University of Maryland in 2003 found that over 70% of politically active Americans favored cutting aid to Israel if it refused to settle that conflict. Furthermore, most Americans recognize that the United States pays a price for its unyielding support of Israel. For example, the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press has been asking Americans for many years whether they sympathize more with Israel or the Palestinians. There has always been much more sympathy for Israel than for the Palestinians. But from 1993 through 2006, the number who are sympathetic to Israel only went above 50% once. That was 52% during the Second Lebanon War of 2006, and was as low as 37% in July 2005. Regarding the consequences of U.S. support for Israel, a Pew survey conducted in November 2005 found that 39% of the American public said that support was, quote, a major cause of global discontent. Among opinion leaders, the numbers were substantially higher. Indeed, 78% of members of the news media, 72% of military leaders, 72% of security experts, and 69% of foreign policy specialists believe that backing Israel seriously damages America's image around the world.
No, they say. Contrary, it is not in America's interest. It is acts against America's interest. Our support acts to enhance terrorism.